Welcome back to Toys on Tap. This week is another crazy good week. Rick Kitagawa is on, and he is talking all things toys and creatives, and really coaching of those creatives. You want to support Toys on Tap, you can follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap. You can like, subscribe, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. If you want to support the show even more, you can jump on that Patreon, patreon.com/toysontap. It's where you're going to get all the good extra stuff, and it is now only $3, no tears, just jumping in. Now let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. What's up, Rick?
What's up, Abe? Sorry I am a bit late, my friend.
No, you're good. Also, what is kaiju coaching?
Oh, that's my... So I have my day job, kind of, is I'm a coach. I'm a life coach for creative people. So I kind of... the metaphor of kaiju coaching is, as you know, with kaiju, they originally are sort of like big, scary, terrifying monsters that are really just people and kind of funny rubber monster suits. And so that's kind of my metaphor for a lot of the psychological hurdles and fears that we harbor. And I think it's a really apt metaphor, because oftentimes the fears we have are like terrifying and scary, but they're really just like parts of ourselves that are actually trying to help us. But then we're scared of them because they look frightening. And instead of like really advocating for them to be helpful parts of our lives, we see them as things that we try to lock away and ignore, and usually to our own detriment. So,
holy moly, we're getting into that, obviously. That's crazy. Rick, welcome to Toys on Tap. I'm glad that you're here. We met at Indie Toy LA, and immediately, like, you've been on the list. And so it was like, now that I've formally met you, it's time to get you on. So I'm pumped to have you on Toys on Tap today.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
We start every episode the same. You got to introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, what you do.
Awesome. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Rick Kitagawa. I am a visual artist, author, toy designer, game designer, maker of lots of things, that, and I really love monsters. In terms of what I do, I think most pertinent to the audience is I make my own soft... well, I don't actually... now, these days, saying you make your own soft vinyl figures has a different connotation
than
designing and producing a soft vinyl figure, which is what I do. But I also make... I sculpt traditionally. I make resin casts and stuff like that. I'm also a kind of traditional painter, digital painter. I write short stories, and kind of everything centers around this world that I've been building called the Order of the Dark Wheel, which is a cult that worships demons trying to extinguish life in the universe. And they're opposed by a group called the Sisters of the Dawn, which are basically a bunch of witches who have, despite being persecuted by humanity throughout society, are doing their best to save the universe. So
just do everything.
A little bit of everything creatively, I'd like to say. I don't know if I do it well, but I at least try to do a little bit of everything. And honestly, that's been a lot of, I would say, need more than desire. Mm. I really do like collaborating with people. And I think I think collaborating with people can be difficult if you haven't like set up the right systems and frameworks and ways of working together to, I think, optimize production sometimes. And so, and also I'm not someone who comes from great means. And so a lot of times it's like, oh, I can't really afford to hire someone to do this thing I don't know how to do. I guess I need to learn how to do it myself. And so that's been a lot of what has kind of spurred me to be this sort of jack of all trades type thing. And also interest too, because there are things that I would like to do that I need help with that I do just have to hire out, because I'm like, I'm actually... either terrible at it and or not really interested in pursuing it too much.
Yeah. Wild. Hey, before we get to any of that, because that's we have a long journey ahead of us. Take me back to childhood, things that you collected, things that you played with when you grew up, all those things. Tell me about those toys.
Yeah, so I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and so I was very fortunate to, I feel like being born in a really great area of toys, like Masters of the Universe. I was big into Ninja Turtles and Thundercats, I think were my three big ones as a kid. And so I remember, yeah, like, always being gravitated towards the villains of any series more so than the heroes, as kind of a monster kaiju guy. Like, I'm never...
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave. Go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So, if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You gotta check it out.
Toy Rats. Toy Rats. YouTube.
Bye.
Really big on figures that sort of look human, because I'm kind of like, I see humans all day, every day. Like, I'm kind of bored of that. I want to see the giant dude with like a leech face, or like, I remember one of my favorite guys was I think Mosquitor. Okay. He's a character from Hordak's team, mm-hmm. Masters of the Universe. And the toy had like this thing where like you pumped a button on his back, and then like fake blood started filling up in this chest cavity. And I thought that was super rad. I was like, I don't know how this works, but this is amazing and I love it. So,
I mean, it's unfair to anyone that grew up before that or after that time period. It's unfair to them. Like, 80s totally. And 90s toys are unreal, unmatched. And like, even with all the goofy stuff, we still don't see anything like that. So there's no wonder that all of us then went into like kaiju making and Sufubi and stuff. Tell me, I mean, because of who you are now and what you do, these toys kind of inform some kind of artistic thing in you. When does that start to pick up in your life? Or at least that you notice that you're like, oh, I want to do art.
Yeah. So as a kid, my mom was really good about fostering the creativity. I remember a story I like to tell is that she bought me washable, like Crayola washable markers, and basically just let me draw on like the stucco or like the white walls of our living room. I would just literally be like drawing this little baby muralist, and she would just like kind of be sitting there reading a book and kind of follow after me. And like, as soon as I was done with an area, she'd just like wipe it clean. But so she'd be like buffing me, and I'd like, I didn't care. I was just like, making stuff. And she would bring home, she worked as a medical assistant at a dermatologist's office. And so right as they were transitioning from dot matrix printers, for everyone that remembers those, but it had the little like tear off
the
track.
Best ones.
But they had like reams of that paper because they had just moved over to like laser printing. Mm-hmm. So I would get these like huge boxes of paper, and I had my giant cookie tin of crayon nubs, and I would just like constantly be drawing all the time. And then I actually kind of stopped doing art, I would say from like fourth grade until pretty much my early 20s, actually. So
holy crap.
Yeah, so what happened is I was homeschooled initially. My mom eventually went back to work. Mm-hmm. My younger brother started public school. I was homeschooled until fourth grade. I started public school, and then I got put into like a gifted program that got quickly put into different other college prep programs. Like, I was in a college prep program in seventh grade, basically. Mm-hmm. And I sort of went down that very traditional academic route, where, you know, I was valedictorian with a 4.897 GPA or something like that. I ended up going to UC Berkeley to study chemical engineering, and I was very much on like that traditional academic excellence path. And then I got to Berkeley and quickly decided, I was like, I'm here now, and I've worked really hard, and now I actually don't care about chemical engineering whatsoever. I got involved with like a political activism group and then a Asian American theater troupe. And I wasn't really doing visual art for the most part. I was really just focused on theater and kind of performing. I was competing in spoken word stuff, doing sketch comedy, doing improv, and auditioning for like community plays and stuff. And then I graduated in 2006 and was like, ooh, jobs. Well, one, I had basically just barely passed all of my, I eventually got a degree in biology, but I like very thinly passed all of my biology classes. I buffered that with my minor in Asian American studies, which writing essays about oppression apparently comes very easy to me. And so that like buffered my GPA to graduate decently. But I still like, if to get a job in biology, I had like zero lab experience besides organic chemistry, in which I did horribly in. And I was like, oh, I guess I could go into teaching or I could go back to school. So I decided to go back to school. I applied for some MFA programs, realized that I was not very good at making art. And I, even though I had a bunch of ideas of kind of like what I wanted to say, I thought that actually going back to school for a BFA and getting a second bachelor's would be more beneficial to me. So I jumped into, I went back to Academy of Art University in San Francisco. And because everyone was like, well, they let anybody in, but if you work really hard, you can learn how to paint. And I was like, fucking sign me up. I did that. I learned printmaking and painting, and I think that's kind of when I really got into kind of the creative world, thinking that could be something that maybe I could do.
That's wild. I mean, I have so many things to talk to you about along that path. First and foremost, those stupid dot matrix printers. Car rental places still use them. What are we doing? Like, that is the most frustrating thing in the world. Also, when I was a little kid, my grandfather had one of those printers, and I got in a lot of trouble because I got into the box of the paper and peeled off all the stuff, and it makes the paper unusable, which is really funny. Tell me about the dynamic between your parents and you. As I mean, you go from being a homeschool kid to being a public school kid. Already a weird transition. Like, hopefully you weren't the weird kid that like they were like, oh, he's homeschooled. But you go through this thing and you get good grades and you have this crazy trajectory to then realize, I don't want to do any of this. Tell me about your parents' reaction to that.
Yeah, you know, I think interestingly enough, like, I know there's sort of the stereotype, like if it's not clear, because I don't think people are seeing me, I'm of Japanese American descent. And I think there's that stereotype of like the, you know, the tiger parents or like the really strict Asian American parents. And fortunately, my parents never really gave that much. They were never harping on me to like perform well, because I think one, you know, my brain, like I think traditionally I would have said I'm neurotypical, but I actually think that I'm not neurotypical in a lot of ways. But my brain does work really well in a way that traditional academic tests and things like that really reward. So, so school wasn't very hard for me, even at like an advanced level throughout most of my childhood. So there was a lot of just support of kind of like, do what you want. Like, you're doing well in school. Like, I got a lot of freedom to like go hang out with friends, because honestly, I'd finished most of my homework before I got home from school. And so it was just kind of like, well, I have a whole evening or afternoon to kill. Like, I was also doing a lot of sports. I played water polo and badminton. I was doing like all sorts of like academic decathlon and science Olympiad and other sports that basically were for smart kids. Or, you know, I also want to say quote unquote smart kids, because, you know, like, I'm a big advocate that everyone has different strengths and weaknesses, and traditional school setting rewards a very, very narrow sliver of the population. But anyway, like, and part of it is that my parents, you know, I'm fifth generation American. Mm-hmm. My parents were very working class. And, you know, at one point, like, we had like I think we declared bankruptcy when I was like 13. And so even though there was never a explicit pressure for me to like do well, I was like, oh, I want to go to college, mm-hmm. and we can't afford it. So like, I need to earn my way in somehow. And so that's why I think I put a lot of pressure on myself to be very like, cool, I'm president of seven clubs. Like winning, like I'm competing in all of this stuff. I volunteer, I play sports year round. I also keep a, you know, straight A GPA. Like, and so I think for me, that was very much this self-directed path that I was going to. And so my parents were actually very chill with it. When I told them I was going back to school to be an artist, my dad wasn't like super happy when I told him, but then pretty quickly he came around. He was like, well, you know, I'm just concerned about your ability to make a living. Like, that's all I really care about. Like, I want you to do what you enjoy. But you know, I can't like pay for this too. And I was like, I'm going to take out private loans. Like, I got this all figured out, you know? And so, yeah, so they were very supportive despite me kind of, I don't know about despite, but they've always been very supportive of me and my creative pursuits.
Yeah. It is wild to come out of a 4-year college to go right back into a possible 4-year degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, because I already had my like an undergraduate degree, mm-hmm. like when I went back to school, they were like, oh, well, you don't have to take any liberal arts like courses because like they all my credits transferred over. So basically I was only taking studio classes, which sounds kind of cool. And I ended up graduating in, I think, in about like 2.5 years.
Okay.
I could have graduated earlier if I think I started out actually as graphic design, went to illustration, then went to fine art printmaking. And so if I had started out just in fine art, I probably would have gotten out in probably a year and a half. But
yeah.
Part of the struggle with that is for anyone who has gone to art school, studio classes are usually quite intensive in terms of amounts of hours and work you have to put into it. And being that I was financing this mostly by myself and through the private loans, it ended up being that I was taking 4 studio classes, working 30 hours a week. And that is a very difficult thing to do, let me tell you. Like, the reason you have math and like English and stuff at art schools is to pad your studio classes. And so because I had to stay as a full-time student, I had to take a certain number of units, meaning that I was not sleeping very much.
Jeez. Did you learn to paint?
I'd like to think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, because if you go into it thinking like, oh, I'm going to learn to paint, and then you choose graphic design as the like initial route that you take, it kind of dampens that whole part. And then you said like printmaking as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So awesome. Graphic design was that like, I need to get a job afterwards.
Yeah.
And then quickly I was like, the level, I love design. I have a lot of respect for graphic designers. I do not personally have the finesse, or I can have it. I choose having that level of perfection and finesse and the fidelity of types of detail work you have to do as a graphic designer. I do not enjoy that. And so I quickly moved to illustration. And then in illustration, I was like, I don't actually want to paint what you're telling me what to paint. And so then I was like, this is actually probably a bad profession for me as well. So then I moved over to fine art and I'm like, I can just make what I want. Let's go. And so I ended up sticking with fine art painting and printmaking.
Heck yeah. So you go through this, you graduate. Tell me that first job.
The first job is me continuing to work at Paper Source. Okay. In San Francisco. I ended up working there a total of about 7.5 years. I actually really love the wedding invitation industry for some okay. weird reason. I like super got into that. But then I eventually, through a long story which we can get into, I started co-owning a gallery workspace in San Francisco.
We got to get into it. We obviously got to. Okay, how did okay. that even happen?
Okay, so shout out to my friend Grant Gilliland. He's an illustrator based out of Ohio. Mm-hmm. At the time, he was in SF. The two of us were working at Paper Source together, and he was like, "Hey, my buddy is in a gallery show," and we were both closing that day. And so he's like, "Hey, you want to roll over to the show afterwards?" I was like, "Oh yeah, sounds good." So we head out relatively close in the neighborhood that I was in. I was nice. I could walk to work every day. I like took the bus down to this gallery called Big Umbrella Studios. And there was an art show going on. And in the back, there was two guys screen printing t-shirts live. And when I studied printmaking in school, it was all like fine art printmaking, and I mainly specialized in silkscreen. Mm-hmm. But I was doing like poster prints. And so I'd been thinking of like, oh, I got to find a way to keep doing this. Because if you know anything about screen printing, there's a lot of like kind of equipment you need. It's like messy. You need like a booth to spray out the emulsion. You need a dark room to expose the screens. There's like a lot of stuff you need.
Yeah.
Very specialized. In San Francisco, we lived in like a 600 square foot studio, or technically one bedroom, but it was basically like a studio. And like there was no room. My wife is also an artist, and we both went to art school. And so like between her studying like stop motion and animation and viz dev, and me studying printmaking and painting, like there was no room in that apartment. It was yeah. all just art supplies and canvas and like like stop motion puppets. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to find out like, okay, where can I get back to printing? And these guys are printing. And so I'm like, oh, I've never learned how to print on fabric. So I start chatting these guys up and I'm asking them questions. And I'm like, hey, do you guys like rent out space, or like kind of what's the deal here? And eventually I was like, yo, like I'm willing to, like, if you guys are open, I would love to just use your dark room to burn my screens. Like I can burn your screens, I can clean screens, like I can do all this other stuff. Can we do like a trade or something? And they're like, yeah, like let's talk about it. And so like a few weeks go by, and then one of them hits me up and he's like, yo, like, do you want to work for us? Like, we need shirts printed, and we have this client. He needs like I think at the time it started out like he needs like 100 shirts a week.
Oh my gosh.
I can teach you how to print. It's the same design. It was just like the same design over and over. He's like, I'll teach you how to print on fabric. And we'll pay you this much for the shirts. And I was like, yeah, dude, sign me up. And he's like, and you can, you know, burn your own screens in your spare time and everything else. And I was like, 100%. This is just a win for me. Yes. And so, and the reason why is because the printer, mm-hmm. Was going away to grad school. So he needed someone to basically fill in for him. And so I had just, I guess, made a good impression, and I asked at the right time. And so I got this job. My business partner, Matt, was like the business side of the thing, mm-hmm. where he was the one dealing with clients and, you know, placing the orders and kind of funding the whole thing. So I started working with him to print all these shirts. Eventually, his other buddy was like, you know, I'm in grad school, I'm going to focus on this. And so Matt offered, he was like, hey, do you want to run this business with me? And I was like, yes. And so we started up the Lords of Print. We became a commercial t-shirt printing company in San Francisco. They still exist today. I eventually left to focus on teaching and my own art. And so, but through that process, the owners of the gallery that they were renting space from wanted to get out. And so we basically bought shares in that gallery, re-ran it for a little bit. I acted as one of the co-curators and workshop directors there for a long time. We eventually sold the business because it wasn't really doing well. And then we just focused on screen printing full time when we ended up, you know, we got our own like warehouse space and shop space and became like a legit profitable company for the two of us.
Holy geez.
So yeah, that was sort of the trajectory. I still work retail for, I think maybe the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was kind of the route into kind of the start of my career, I guess.
I mean, it's a crazy start to come out of college and then go into, you're able to step into something that you like and then become a business owner so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where, I mean, I had tons of imposter syndrome around this because like I hadn't studied business prior to this. I think at best was, I think also at that time I was volunteering to organize the San Francisco Zine Fair.
Okay.
Or Zine Fest, excuse me. And so that had given me kind of a little bit of entrepreneurial kick of like, oh, I'm selling buttons and my like zines at this thing. And so I was kind of used to like thinking, oh yeah, you got to get out there and like learn how to talk about your work and all of these other skills. And so yeah, it was like really weird to be like, oh yeah, I run this company.
Yeah.
You know, and at the beginning, so Matt was working for a fintech company, and so he would be like at his day job working, and then he'd be like on the side emailing clients and stuff like that. And so in some ways I felt kind of, you know, like coming from not having a lot of money and kind of financing my life on loans and like other things, I think I've always had a weird issue with money and relationship to money. And so, you know, this was this other weird thing of like, you know, I saw myself as like, I'm an artist, but I also work retail, but now I own this business, but I didn't actually invest anything. I sort of just like am doing the sweat labor and equity, and all of my partners, both with the gallery and Matt, were always super, super supportive. They're like, we totally get it. Like, it's not a big deal. We work jobs too. Yeah. And like, we all kind of, it's just our jobs pay us better because they're actual careers and, you know, you're working selling wedding invitations. So
yeah.
Which
are you designing these invitations as well? Is that where your love for that comes?
You know, actually, no, I just really like paper. And I think that comes with the printmaking background of like being like, oh, what kind of paper is going to be the best for this process or this piece? Or like, oh, like I wish this paper came in a different thickness, but or a different color, or like, oh, I like, what if I made my own paper? And so I'm like a big paper person. And so like helping people create their wedding invitations on a budget, getting them as close to what they want for like their, like, you know, in theory, like their special day, right? Like hopefully something they never have to go through again. Like this is hopefully a one and done type thing. That was just really rewarding for me. And I got to talk about paper and color and like color theory and font. And so I wasn't actually designing anything, and I was just like helping people kind of design theirs. And I love that. Like if that paid me like a livable salary wage, like I would have done that. And to be fair, also,
we interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this. Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet. Oh my, we're doomed. Wait, salvation. Hooray, we're saved, DOV2. Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures.
I feel like my life requirements are just really high because of all of my student loans. And so a lot of I know a lot of artists who are full-time or, you know, can go working a lot less than I have to work because they didn't pay for 2 degrees with student loans. Like
right.
So so anyway, but I wish I could. I'd be very happy actually working in an art store or selling wedding invitations. Like if that was my full-time job, I would actually be pretty happy. It's just that it wasn't kind of doing enough to really make a dent in the student loan specter that constantly looms over me.
So we jumped into toys. That's how we're really doing it.
Yeah.
So you get all this way into this. You move through that. When does art, I mean, art is like breathed into you to the point where everything you do, when does art pivot towards this is career, this is what we're doing, this is, I'm no longer working retail, I need to do this to fulfill something?
I mean, I think that was pretty early on, is this is where I want to be. I mean, in full transparency, like, art still doesn't fully pay the bills for me, right? Like, my main job is I'm a life coach for creatives. I run my own private practice. I used to do some leadership coaching and kind of business coaching for through a program called the Alt MBA, which if any marketing fans knows, I got to work with Seth Godin through that program. And so that's kind of the main thing I do. Like, I've worked in consultancies and stuff. And so art has always been the passion that never really paid the bills to. I think also from, like, I think I'm clear enough as a business owner to look at, one, how much time I spend on the art, and also the niche that I've decided to focus on is not necessarily like the big money maker. I mean, like toys, enamel pins, like that's kind of what I found people really gravitate towards. And, you know, I've talked to Skinner about this, and he was like, he told me the phrase, the way he thinks about his art is like art for the working class. And I was like, oh, that is, like, that clicked, and I resonate so well with that, of like doing, you're making monsters and you're selling art, but it's also, you know, to the average everyday person. And in a lot of ways, like, I find myself, I do a lot of conventions and things like that, and I find myself always so humbled and honored that people are spending like their money on my stuff, when you could be buying, you know, all of these other amazing artists who are out there. I don't even want to name names, because it's like there's so many great artists out there, and them going through an entire hall and then coming back and being like, I want this toy. And I'm just like, it, like I know I can get in the mindset of like, oh, am I doing my numbers from last year and stuff like that, but then I come back and it's like this kid, you know, like the thing that break, like, every year, like every time I see like a kid who's like, I've got like $30 for this entire show. And then like, they come by and they're like, I love your monsters. And then they leave. And then at the end they come back and they're like, I want this. And like, they haven't spent any money. And they're like, dude, like, you want this over everything else? Like, that's just like, makes me tear up. It's just like so amazing to have people from especially limited means. Cause I think I really identify, you know, I've identified as someone, who hasn't had a lot of money most of my life. And so for them to decide to spend their tiny little budget on mine, or, you know, even people who are, you know, they're working two jobs to make a living. And then they're like, this enamel pin speaks to me, you know, like that's, I think, the biggest reward for me. And so, working class art for the everyday person, you know?
Which is crazy, because when you look at like kaiju monsters and stuff, the average person is like, what is this? But I like the idea of the art for the working class. Fast forward a little bit. Take me into when we decided we wanted to make toys. We can go down one of two routes right now. We're going to hit both anyways. So it's like, either you can take me down when we first started wanting to make toys, or when we started this kaiju coaching kind of coaching thing in all creative aspects. So you get to choose your own adventure.
Cool. Let's do toys first, because that's pretty straightforward. My friend Christina Duke invited me to table with her at DesignerCon, because she was like, oh, like booths are like the same price as two artist tables. And so I was like, yeah, let's do it. And so we started tabling together. That was, I think, in I think 2016 was my first DCon. And then I was just like, what are these toys? These things are awesome. Like, you know, I had really been out of the toy scene for, you know, 20 some years, and coming back in and seeing like Sofubi, I was like, this is my jam. And boy, are these expensive, but these are awesome. And I remember so I started like buying resin cast and stuff like that, and really wanting to get into it, but I didn't have any sculpting skills or casting knowledge. And it was slowly kind of building that up. And then I remember my first soft vinyl toy that I bought, or my first Sofubi, was a Wonder Goblin Skinner Fungoid Man piece. Marbled. I think this was Decon. It was the first year in Anaheim. Okay. This is when I first met James and picked up one of his pieces. But and then I was hooked. And then I was like, wait, you can paint these? And so then it was, and this was long before Vinyl Wonder. And so it was like me trying to figure out how to get vinyl paint into the country, and like having to pay exorbitant prices through other people. I went to Japan in 2018 and tried to I bought a bunch of vinyl paint, and then realized that I should not be taking it on the plane. Yeah. So TSA don't come for me. TSA is probably gonna come for me just for my political beliefs. But anyway, I packed like a third of it in my luggage to be like, maybe they'll think that it's like, you know, I'm doing research to be like, what are the pressure and temperature differentials on the cargo area of a plane? I'm like, because I don't actually want to blow up the plane at all. Even though the paint's highly flammable, I was like, oh, it actually gets really cold there, so I should be fine. So I'll put a few bottles there, that should be fine. And then I actually ended up, there's this poor, Japanese airline worker who I'm like, can you throw this away? And I basically hand her a shopping bag filled with like brand new vinyl paint, because I'm like, I can't bring this in. And then she's like, what?
And I
show her the thing where it says like flammable, no airplane, and she's like, oh. And like, I don't speak Japanese, and so like we're trying to figure this out, and she's like, okay, and just takes it and like puts it next to the trash can. And I'm just like, oh
yeah.
But so I did get some paint home, which is great, but most of it I had to surrender.
I mean, that's a bummer. You get there, it's an expensive hobby to get into.
Totally.
Especially just the collecting of soft vinyl and Sofubi toys. I mean, I look over and just the collection, it's too much.
It's a lot.
And then it's like, then you start to like fixate on the artists that you start to love their work. And then if you start to meet artists, it's so much all at once. And as you do that, you start buying and collecting, and then you start painting. When do we start making?
We don't start making. Well, in terms of vinyl, my first figure, Nightmare Chan, came out 2023, I think. Okay. So about 2 years ago, I had been
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 3.75 inch or 1/18 scale. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's COYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters. Empire Blisters.
Trying to get quotes for figures, just reaching out to a lot of vinyl people, and they just kept kind of ignoring me when I was not like ready to pull the trigger. I'm just like, I need to know how much money this is going to cost so I can crowdfund it, because I don't have this kind of money. And so I was just not really getting good answers, or like, I didn't even have like full figures. It's like, hey, here's kind of like a mock-up, like, you know, just so you get the sizing and jointing. Like, I didn't realize how much went into like joint angles and things like that affect production prices. And so, like, I get it now, but, you know, and I don't hold any grudges against the many Sofubi factories who I'm like, give me a quote. I want this to be like American style. I need quotes and I'll send you revisions and like, I'll get more quotes. And like, that's not how we do things here. But eventually, I met Paul at Mile High Sofubi, and we kind of got a process going, and I managed to scrounge up enough money to get molds made, and then I ran a crowdfunding campaign, and Nightmare Chan is now
a little thing. Yeah. I mean, it's no small feat to make a toy, right? Like, we have toys everywhere once you start collecting. And so it's like, you realize what goes into this whole process, and it's like sleepless nights. It's deciding colors and sculpts and finding the right people. It is a funny thing that on the first toy, when you start making it, the factories are like, we don't really care. And then after you pay for one, anytime you send like, hey, can I get a quote on this one? They're like, yep, here you go. And we're like almost on first name basis with a couple of these factories, which is really funny. So you do that. When does the creative coaching kind of pour into this? Because I think that is something, I don't know, you know how to describe it. Something that so many people can benefit from in their creative processes and their careers, and just having someone to bounce ideas off of. So when does that kind of take hold?
Yeah. So in 2018, I realized I was running a monthly enamel pin / short horror fiction subscription thing called the Evil Pin Club. And so you'd get an enamel pin and a short story every month. And the short story, like, was about the monster that I made a pin of. And so I was running that. I ran it for about 14 months before I closed it. But kind of in the midst of it, I was teaching entrepreneurship and business skills at Academy of Art at this point. So I had moved away from silk screening to teaching young people, or just people of all ages, at Academy of Art University. And I was doing that, and I was also struggling to scale the Evil Pin Club. And I was like, oh, how could I, maybe it's a marketing thing. I wasn't quite sure what wasn't landing. Maybe it was just my art, or, you know, I wasn't really sure. Maybe it's the writing. I don't really know. I was feeling really stuck. I had been teaching for a while, and I was feeling that I wasn't able, like, I was teaching the same class. So I would teach like hundreds of students every semester, and it would be the same class again. I would update the curriculum a little bit based on new information that was coming out, but it was kind of getting a little routine, and I was just really feeling stuck. And so I, on a whim, signed up for the Alt MBA, and because I had been a big fan of Seth Godin's work for a very long time, and I saw that this was a program that he had started, I wanted to actually join his original cohort. Didn't have the money, so I just didn't apply, and I forgot about it. And then this time, I still really didn't have the money. I ended up asking my wife for a small loan to pay for it. I got in, and that sort of changed my life in a lot of ways in terms of how I think about problem solving and coaching oneself and framing of issues and making better decisions and a lot of different things. And I was very surprised when I got an email after the program asking me to apply to coach the program. And so I started coaching for the Alt MBA and kind of learning those skills, working with, you know, people in very different lives than me. So, you know, I've coached like vice presidents at Starbucks and things like that, which is like a really weird thing to me, not having very much corporate background. But yeah, I realized, I think coaching is very much less about the type of coaching I do. I'm not going to go in and be like, this is how you need to run your business or something. Mine is really more of a posture of listening and asking the right questions to get people to make the decisions themselves. That's going to be the best because they're the subject matter experts, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't know what it's like to run an entire division at Starbucks, but I could ask you the questions that get you to think about how you're leading, how you've been led in the past, what your teammates need, that then you're going to likely make the most informed decision. You just needed a partner to kind of work through that with. Mm-hmm. And so, after that, I was like, you know, I do want to work more with creatives. And so that's when I started a couple years later, started Kaiju Coaching. And and I decided to go kind of all in and really integrate my love of monsters and creativity and art with this skill set of helping, a bunch of people. And that's kind of where we're at now.
I do have to ask, during this coaching, do you have like base points that are based off of certain monsters?
I started that kind of like this framework, but I find like it's really more of just, I think, a metaphor, because everyone comes in with sort of different touch points of monsters. Like I really think like the doppelganger is a very like powerful archetype, and that really kind of reflects, you could talk about like Jungian theory around the shadow self, things like that. But I think that is usually something that really gets to people. But I also have an exercise around something that we like to call the imposter monster. And so oftentimes we hear the imposter syndrome show up, or fear or self-doubt, if you're not like all up in the psychological terms, but just our fear or self-doubt often sounds like our own voice because we've sort of internalized it. And so I kind of lead people to do like a really simple drawing exercise where you draw out like, what does your fear look like? And if it was a monster, like, what does it look like? And then it's like, okay, you have this monster that, and for actual illustrators, I usually tell them to use their non-dominant hand because I don't want this to actually be like a really cool, scary illustration. And then you're kind of like, okay, if this was like a silly monster, how would you make it look silly? And so then you kind of like take some of the fear away from it. And then we talk about, what does it sound like? Where are we hearing it? Just kind of spatially in our bodies. And then moving that voice to your small toe or your pinky toe, which I specifically call it the pinky toe because I think it's even funnier. And it also, then when you move that voice and you move that fear to your pinky toe, it can't, like, everyone always comes up with the same thing, which is that there's like, oh, I'm a really silly voice like this. And then you can't really take it as serious. And really it's building that psychic distance to kind of say like, oh, like, now I can hear you for what you are, which is usually like trying to protect me in some ways. It's trying to protect me from rejection. It's trying to protect me from judgment or shame that I'm feeling about this work that I'm doing. And once you have that distance and you can kind of laugh at it, you can realize that it's actually trying to help you. And that's kind of the first step in really building a new relationship to these voices that you're hearing in your head. And that can help you start reframing how you're looking at challenges or looking at things that you don't like to do or things that you're scared to do. And so that's really where like the kaiju part comes from. It's a metaphor again of big scary things that are actually just funny, nice people wearing rubber suits.
Yeah. I think that it helps because there's people, you know, as we've started, like, Toys on Tap has started working with artists more, you get people that come in and I ask kind of the same questions, like, do you have a market for this? Do you think you can sell 100? Or like, is this something you want to pursue? Or, and I have to ask those questions because I'm funding it. But the questions I wish I could ask is, do you actually care about this? Like, are you passionate about this figure? Or are you just making it because it'll sell? And I think you're asking those really good questions and dealing with different parts of them selling or them being a creative or them being in any space that is creative and still knowing who they are. And that's cool. That's really cool. We need more of that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, people can always get a hold of me.
And then at some point, you became the one half of a podcast.
Indeed.
Creative journey.
Yeah. So that came from me being hired as the DesignerCon community manager for their Discord server.
Awesome.
And as most people who are familiar with DesignerCon knows, not a lot happens between December and, I don't know, September of the year. And so I was like, I like being paid to hang out in Discord and talk about toys with people. Yeah. How can I provide some value to the community and to the company? And so I had met Chris through an event that they were having at 3D Retro, and we really hit it off. And so then a big thing that we really don't like about a lot of interviews that you, when you have a favorite artist who's like, you know, doing big gallery shows and selling out things, and you're like, oh, I want to learn more about them, you inevitably find a lot of print interviews where they're like, yeah, so I drew a lot as a kid. And then I like sold my company and now I make toys. And you're like, wait, like
how? I need more. Yeah.
How, what? No, like, was it that easy? Like, you know, or like, it's really frustrating that you don't get to hear, you know, like the full story. And I really appreciate that on your show, you do get into the childhood and like, how are people getting to where they are? Because I think that's missing so much. And so that's what we really wanted to do with Origins of Creative Journey, right? It is like, what are the ups and the downs? Because we want to destigmatize failure. We want to show people different ways and their different paths to success. And that's why we like interviewing both, you know, big name artists, quote unquote, like people who you might recognize, and then also people all along the journey, you know, and we want to destigmatize having a quote unquote day job while you're building your art career, because the reality is so few people can do art 100% full time. And even then, a lot of times it's like, oh, like they're this huge toy designer and they're also freelancing and they're doing murals and they're doing commissions. And it's like, the full scope of what it means to make a living off your craft is actually quite varied. And I don't think a lot of people get that. They just see like, oh, they have 50, you know, they have 5 million followers on Instagram. They must be able to just do whatever they want. And you're like, no, they have clients. Yeah. They're working with like Coca-Cola, but do you think Coca-Cola just says do whatever you want? Like, there's brand guidelines. There's like all of this stuff. Like there's all these constraints and there's like deadlines and like unreasonable requests and all of these other things that you have to deal with, but no one really talks about that. And so that's really what we wanted to do with the podcast. And that's kind of what's led me to continue to work with DesignerCon and kind of, you know, eventually worm my way in. So I'm helping Ben and Kevin out a little bit more this year with organizing the show and things like that.
That's cool. That's cool. I think I'm always in to when artists are given more platforms and they can talk through anything, because then you get messages of other people that heard an interview and they're like, this is why I did this. This is why. Or the best one is, oh, I didn't even know they existed. I went and bought their work. Like the best way they can support. And I love that. With all of these things, because you are doing no shortage of anything, what's next for Rick?
What's next for me? Right now, as of recording, I am just in crazy crunch mode trying to get DesignerCon off the ground. And I'm helping run a new kind of area. We call it the community activation, where we'll have like some toys from people who weren't able to make it to the show. We'll have like a lot of interactive activations. We have some galleries where I'm helping coordinate the Kaleidos Collective's charity fundraiser thing, and as well as the DesignerCon gallery. And so a lot of cool stuff with that. I have some work in the show as well, trying to get my own exclusives done for the show. But I think the next kind of big thing on the horizon is I'm kind of stepping into game design a little bit more. And so I'm looking to do a TTRPG zine, kind of my own world type thing, more Order of the Dark Wheel, but as a game form, as it was kind of originally intended. So that should be coming in March. I'll be having a campaign on BackerKit. And of course, I'm working on more soft vinyl figures. It's just a matter of getting a sculpt to where I really like it, and it's also producible, and also raising the money to get molds made, because we all know that is
not a cheap venture. Yeah. Holy moly. Every time they send me back a quote, it's just a deep breath and just, all right. Yeah, but it's worth it. It's worth it. Rick, it's been so good having you on Toys on Tap. The amount of stuff that you're pouring into the community and the amount of stuff that you are giving back and just building, it's insane. And thank you for doing all that you do.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been super.